All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Greg Cazanza. I am here today to go over Virtual Machine Manager 2012.0 to cluster to cloud, all within 1 hour. I want to start by thanking all of you for getting your tech ed off to a start or an early start with Virtual Machine Manager. So I'm going to be covering a lot of breadth of the product. I'm really going to go into the most detail on the actual OS deployment process. There are a number of other sessions throughout the week that you can go to where you can learn about some of these areas in a lot more depth than what I'm going to cover now. So take a good look at the related content slide at the end if you want to find out which sessions those are. I'll point some of those out at the end. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to help you so that when you go back home after this this week, you'll be able to impress your friends, coworkers, colleagues, hopefully your boss, by being able to start with a bare metal machine and build a highly available private cloud in under an hour using VMM. So has anybody, did anybody here go to the Microsoft Management Summit a couple months ago in Las Vegas? See a few of you. Well, I encourage you to go back and watch the keynote session from that. We showed some of the, just kind of a peek at the bare metal deployment process in VMM 2012. And part of that process and part of what was talked about in that session is how you can take these raw resources and begin to shape them and allocate them to build different layers of abstraction that will let you get to a private cloud. So that's a lot of what I'm going to cover today. I'm going to share some tips and tricks along the way, some of the things that we've learned over the last 2 years that we've been working on this release. I'm going to share some of those so that hopefully if you run into some of the things that I cover, you'll know what to do. So how does the zero to cloud workflow work within VMM? Well, when we started learning about the process and designing it, we talked to some of our very large data centers within Microsoft. Microsoft runs some of the largest data centers in the world. So we wanted to talk to them and figure out how do they do things. Well, the first thing they said is they need consistency. They order their machines in giant shipping containers. They're all exactly the same. So their hardware starts off the same. They then take a consistent OS image that they then deploy to every single one of those machines. If something starts to act funny or doesn't work right on one of those nodes in their hardware, they just re-image the machine. It actually takes longer for them to try and troubleshoot it than it does for them to just re-image it back to the original OS image that it started with. And of course, if that doesn't work, then they just mark the that particular machine as requiring repair, and they just leave it out of service until they get around to swapping it out. So we decided, well, how can we apply these learnings to, our customers' environments? Well, first of all, very few of you have the consistency in hardware that, the Microsoft data centers have. You have a diverse infrastructure where you have computers that are manufactured by different vendors. You have different BIOS versions within those machines, different firmware versions. You have different types of storage. Well, we want to take all of those and apply logical and standardized constructs on top of that. So we apply things like logical networks to our networking so that you have a logical view of what your network looks like. We apply storage classifications to your storage. So instead of seeing, NetApp or EMC, you see gold, silver classification that really identifies a quality of service rather than a specific, piece of hardware. And then for your servers, your Hyper-V hosts, we apply what's called a host profile. And I'll show you that in a lot of detail as we go on. That host profile basically is what lets you get the consistent software layer on top of your server hardware. So once we have this standardized layer of software on top of your diverse hardware, we can then start to build a cloud abstraction. This is really how you're going to expose it to your self-service users, to basically the people that are deploying the applications, building the applications that are running on the fabric. The important thing about this cloud is it separates the actual fabric hardware and from what the user actually sees. It truly is a cloud, and what's underneath is elastic and grow, shrink, can get swapped out, and the users that are above the cloud that you delegate the capacity to, those users don't know what's running underneath. They really just see a cloud. And finally, once you have users out there, they're going to want to do something, so they're going to deploy standardized services on top of that, which will contain their applications. So I'm going to show you all of this in the next hour. And so in order to do that, I need to get started. So I'm going to jump right into my demo. I've got a lot of demos planned. And I'm going to get my my Hyper-V host deployment kicked off and started right away, because that's the longest operation. It takes about 35 minutes. So before I do that, let me give you a brief overview of what I have, what I've already done in my VMM server. Hopefully, a lot of you have had a chance to either install VMM 2012 or use some of the early releases that are available. So I've got it installed here. I've already set up my networking. So I've got some number of logical networks defined. Here's one that I've defined for my host networking. This is for the management networks. It contains IP pools that we'll be using for getting addresses from when we do our deployment. You can see I have storage classifications already defined. So I have a NetApp array that I currently have added using an SMIS provider. And then I've broken that down into a number of classifications. So later on, I'll be allocating storage from this array to give to the cluster. And then I've created a host group. This is my brand new host group. This basically represents my brand new data center that I'm going to be standing up. So I'm going to run the add resources wizard to kick off this process. And I'll talk more about what's going on behind the scenes after I get it started. So first thing I'm going to select is to provision a physical computer from the bare metal machine. You have another number of other options. If you already have existing hosts, you can select these. And we need a way to talk to that physical machine. So most servers these days in data centers, they have what's called a baseboard management controller, or BMC. And that basically is like a person sitting next to the computer that you can call up and say, turn it on, turn it off, or, are you there, or is my computer on? But it's just a little computer, a little, board that's inside of these servers that's plugged into the network. It's basically always on as long as the computer has power. So you can reboot the guest OS, and the BMC will stay active. Of course, you need credentials, and here's the first tip I'm going to give you of the day. When you're creating RunAS accounts, try to name them a little better than HP BMC and BMC HP if you want to know what they actually mean. I know the BMC HP is the one that I want today, so go ahead and select that. And there are a number of different interfaces or ways to talk to these BMCs. The first two are standard protocols that we support. IPMI is an industry standard, which is probably the most common. If you don't know which of these to select, select IPMI. So, for example, ILO and HP supports IPMI. If you have a ILO 2, you may need to update your firmware to get to a version that supports IPMI. Dell's DRAC supports IPMI. Even Cisco UCS supports IPMI. So I don't think I found a machine that we've tested with that doesn't support it. So that's generally your best guess for if you don't know what to pick. We also support SMASH. We view SMASH as a SMASH over WSMAN as a more strategic direction that we want to see these BMCs go for communication, because we can get a lot more richer information from a SMASH interface than we can from IPMI. IPMI is somewhat limited in what we can get from discovery. And then, of course, we have an extensible interface as well. So here is a kind of a dummy provider that I installed that gives me access to if you find a machine that doesn't support one of these standards, either you or that vendor can write a custom provider that implements the necessary functions so that we can discover and then control the power of that server. So I'm going to go ahead and select IPMI, go on to the next page, and I'm going to actually discover the machine that I'm going to deploy to. So you can do a single address. It'll go right to the, once it finds it, it'll go right to the configuration page. But I'm going to go ahead and do a range so that you can see how we discover multiple machines. So this is my range. You can do a fairly wide range. When you do this, we actually go out and query each of the machines in this range. We'll do 20 machines at a time, and as they respond, we'll show the output right here on this panel. We show a number of pieces of information. We show the IP address of what we discovered. This should match to the range that you just entered. We show the SMBIOS GUID. So this is the unique ID that we'll use to match the machine when it reboots later on into Pixie Boot. The SMBIOS GUID is very important. Occasionally, you'll find a machine that's generally defective and will return an invalid SMBIOS GUID. The other thing we found is with HP's Virtual Connect, if you have virtual IDs enabled on HP Virtual Connect, you'll actually get a different ID back when it boots into WDS than you get when you discover through IPMI. So you actually need to disable the virtual IDs if you're using HP Virtual Connect. That's just a little tip. All right, I'm going to select the machine that I want to discover. I just happen to know it's ends with .224. I can verify the SM BioSquid. Make sure that's the one I want. So I'm going to select the host group I want to put this new machine into. This is my Zero to Cloud demo host group that I showed you. And I'm going to select the host profile I want to use. I organize my host profiles generally by cluster, because generally within a cluster, you're going to have the same set of settings you need to apply to every host in the cluster. This host profile, I'll show you it after I get the deployment started, is essentially the recipe for how the OS is going to be configured on there. You'll want to keep it around the host profile and all the components that are used within the host, or referenced within the host profile, because later on, if you want to add another node to your cluster, you have the recipe that was used to build it. So, if 6 months down the road, you don't remember exactly how you did it, it's okay, because you have, the recipe for how that was done. So I'm going to hit next and give my computer a name. This is going to be HV208. I'm going to skip the Active Directory checks. I know this machine's already in Active Directory from some of my tests that I was doing. We do that check to make sure that we don't accidentally clobber a machine that's already out there. I'm going to specify the MAC address. So this MAC address is needed if you're giving static IPs. The reason for it is so that these machines will generally have more than one network adapter in them. And in order for us to know which network adapter to actually set the IP address on, you have to tell us somehow. So that's what this MAC address is for. So this needs to match one of the addresses in the machine. Once we've done that, then we can say what IP address we want to give it. I'm going to give it an IP address from this IP pool. And I know exactly which one I want to give it. Next, and finish. So that's it. Now you can go get some coffee. Relax for about 35 minutes, because that's how long it's going to take to deploy. We still have a lot more to do, though, so we're not going to have that luxury today. So while that's deploying, let me show you the host profile I use real quick. So in the library is where the host profiles are stored. You can see we have a node called host profiles. And here are all the ones that I have in my system. HV cluster B2 is the one that I selected. I'm going to open up the properties of that. See, it contains the name, of course. It contains a reference to a VHD file that's in our library. Now, when we deploy the OS, we don't actually copy all the individual files of the OS out onto the file system. We actually copy just one VHD, which contains the OS already configured. This VHD needs to be sysprepped. There are a number of ways you can generate the VHD. You can start with the same golden image you use for your VMs. If you don't require a lot of customization of your VHD, you can just basically use that, and that's exactly what we have here. You can also deploy this to a machine, customize it. If you need any extra software installed that needs to go out to every machine, you can install that in advance. And then you re-sysprep the VHD and copy it back to the library server afterward. So there are a number of ways of doing that. We also recommend that you use fixed-sized VHDs during deployment, since those are the ones that are recommended by Microsoft for production. If you are doing test deployments or you have a demo to do and you want it to go faster, then you can say, do not convert the VHD, in which case it'll just copy the dynamic VHD out to the system. Now we do show you a rough estimate of the amount of disk space that's needed, and that's important for two reasons. Number one, if it's a fixed disk, you need to have that amount of space. Plus, you need the amount of space needed for the paging file that the OS will create, because that actually goes on the physical disk when you're booting from VHD. If you're using dynamic VHD, if you're not doing the conversion, well, the first time the OS boots, it's going to expand out to its full size anyway. It basically does it sparsely and expands out to its full size. So you need that much space, plus still space for the page file. And that's important because the page file actually gets created first before the expansion. And if you have a lot of memory in your machine, that page file is going to be the size of your memory. So if you have 64 gigs of RAM in your machine, you're going to get a 64 gig page file. Then your dynamic disk is going to expand to, in this case, 40 gigs. So you'd better have a 100 gig disk out there, or you're going to get a boot failure when it tries to boot. So it's another tip that we've learned last couple years. So, the other things in this host profile. before I move on. So we also have some basic hardware configuration. So I showed you the static IP address of the host that I'm deploying. This is where we define which logical network that pool is going to come from. You can also use DHCP if some of you use DHCP in your data centers. We have to have information about how to format the partitions that we're gonna configure on the machine. It is a bare metal machine, so it's not gonna have the disks formatted in advance. And then the other thing we do is we will inject drivers into the VHD before we boot for the first time. This also lets you keep your OS image. We want you to put as few customizations in this OS image as possible so that as you service the VHD over time, you aren't tied to the drivers and things that are very specific to your hardware. We want to try to keep that abstraction. So you can specify either letting the drivers match by plug-and-play ID or by specific tags. Now, these drivers are located in our VMM library. You just drop them in there. You copy the files into there, and then we will refresh in the library and figure out what drivers are there for matching. Next is the OS configuration. This is very similar to what you would see for the OS configuration of a VM. It has which domain you want to join, admin password, variety of the typical customization settings. One of the important things is an answer file. With this, you can specify some information that isn't predefined in our general settings section. So if you want to enable RDP, for example, on this machine by default, you can specify an answer file that will do that as part of the deployment. And then finally, host settings are basically just the default placement path. One of the things about booting from VHD is that the actual VHD becomes your C drive and the physical disk becomes the D drive. So by default, we actually mark that C drive, which is the virtual disk, as not available for placement so that you don't accidentally deploy a VM, which contains on a VHD, into that VHD. You don't want nested VHDs just for performance reasons. So we automatically exclude that VHD volume. All right, so I'm going to cancel out of this because we don't want to make any changes. So there's my host is already being deployed. Let's switch over now and start to create our cluster. So I've actually got another couple hosts that I've already deployed. It's a little bit like a cooking show where you have your recipe that's already in the oven and another one that's already finished. So I'm just going to copy these two nodes over. These are two nodes that I already deployed in advance using the exact same host profile. And I'm going to go ahead and create a cluster from these right now. Now, before I can create the cluster, though, I need to do one thing. I need to allocate storage. So I'm going to go down to my storage section and allocate my storage. So your storage, I'm going to go to my classification. I'm going to allocate gold storage. And I'm going to go to create logical unit. And I'm going to create two LUNs. I'm going to create one for the actual CSV that I'm going to create. This is going to be called HV cluster V2. I'm going to make this one a 40 gig. So it's actually going out and creating this LUN on the NetApp array. It'll take a minute for it to create and refresh in. In the meantime, I'm going to create a second one for my witness disk, HV cluster B2W. And this one I'm just going to leave as 1 gig. You don't need a lot of space for that. I'm going to create that. You can see the 40 gig drive has already been created. I'm going to go ahead and let those finish. And then I'm going to go back up to my fabric where I will create my cluster. So one of the other things that's new in VMM 2012 is our ability to create, add nodes, and generally do a lot more cluster management than we could do before in 2008 R2. Before, really, all we could do was add those clusters and use them as is. Now we can actually create new clusters directly from within the VMM console. And as part of this creation, we're going to go through and we're going to enable the cluster feature within the host. We're going to go and configure storage. We're going to configure the networking, basically turn this bare metal machine that I just deployed into a cluster. I'm going to do HV cluster B2. Of course, need credentials for that. Got my domain credentials. I'm going to hit next. I'm going to select my demo host group. Now you can see I have these two machines here already deployed. The third machine that I'm currently deploying, even though we show it here, it's considered an undeployed host at this point, so it doesn't show up here yet. Once that job completes in probably another 30 minutes, then it would be available for use in the cluster. So I'm going to select both of these nodes and add them. And it's strongly recommended that you do the cluster validation test. We'll do that as part of the job, the cluster creation job. I'm going to skip it. Otherwise, we'd be sitting here staring at each other for 30 minutes while we wait for that to complete. This will save us a lot of time. All right, next, we're going to give the cluster an IP address. We can pick one from a pool, but I know exactly which address I want for this cluster. 10.177.18.139. So this will be the cluster name and the cluster address. Oh, one thing I forgot to do. Once I created the storage, I need to actually add it to the host group. So, you know, the storage by default doesn't actually become available in the host groups to use. You have to actually make it available so that you don't get other admins accidentally using storage they're not supposed to. So I'm going to go to the storage tab on the host group, and I'm going to allocate those LUNs that I just created to this host group. So here are the two LUNs that I created. It's an important step. So now they've been added. Now they'll be available to the cluster creation wizard. Back to do this again. Type correctly. Click my two nodes. Skip cluster validation. Give it an IP address. Now you can see my storage shows up. I have my two clusters. I can tell how I want them formatted. I want the big one as CSV. You can see we automatically mark the smaller of the LUNs as the witness disk. So that is already automatically selected. We also, if you right-click, you'll see we have a few other options. Here we have, in particular, the option to force format. If this was a LUN that was already created at some time in the past and you're basically redeploying or recreating this cluster, the file system on that LUN, or that LUN will have a file system. And to be safe, we'll fail the job if that cluster already has, or we won't add the storage to the cluster if that LUN has a file system on it already. But we do give you the option to force format. If you know for certain that you want to blow away whatever's on there, you can go right ahead and do that. I know that this is a new cluster, so I'm not actually going to select that, or it's a new LUN. So we also have the ability to create cluster networks. I've actually already done that in advance, so no logical networks show up here. I did that in advance because these machines actually only have one network adapter, and I didn't want to lose connectivity. So I'm going to go ahead and finish. I'll show you those networks, though, after the cluster gets created. And you can see that a create cluster job gets kicked off. So now this cluster is getting created. It'll take it a little while. We can look at the job and see what it's actually doing. Let's see, install cluster. You can see we install the failover cluster feature in the OS, like I mentioned. We'll go create the logical networks if they haven't been created already. We register storage to the cluster, mount the storage, and then actually finally create the cluster at the end. So we're going to go through and all that's going to happen in the meantime. All right, while that's going on, let's switch back to our slides for a little bit. I do have some slides here still. So we kicked off the bare metal deployment. I skipped the post-deployment GCE scripts. So one of the things that you want to do as you do your deployments, there's some additional customizations that you want to do. We call these GCEs, or generic command executions. Basically, there are two opportunities for you to execute these GCEs during the bare metal deployment process. You can do pre-deployment GCEs, which I list down at the bottom after the demo, in which you will do this before the actual OS gets booted in the VHD. And these pre-deployment GCEs, they're designed for you to be able to update your firmware to get it to the current version that you need. Again, you want the consistent layer across your environment. So we want you to do pre-deployment GCEs for that, and it'll get all of your machines at the same firmware levels. And then also, if you need to configure RAID, a lot of these machines, when you order them, they don't have the RAID configured for your local storage the way you want it. So you can run a pre-deployment GCE to configure that RAID on the local disks as well. For post-deployment GCEs, it's very rare that you only have one NIC in a host like these that I'm deploying to. You actually will have four, five, six, I've heard as many as eight NICs in a host. And the reason for that is because you're going to team them. You know, you want your NICs, your networking, to be very reliable. So you're going to do NIC teaming. So for that purpose, with 2008 R2, Windows had no NIC teaming support in the box. You had to use third-party drivers, third-party tools to do that. So in order to do that, we have post-deployment GCE scripts. So let me actually show you that. I do have one machine on my demo environment that has multiple NICs. This is actually a Dell machine. Let me find where I hit it. Of course, in the last one I select. There it is, HV Dell. If I look at the properties, you can see I have 5 NICs in this machine. Hardware. Actually, I have 6. Okay, even better. So I'm going to take these 4 HP NICs and create one big team out of them. In order to do that, I have a script that I run, and it'll do what's called a script command. The script command is basically runs from the VMM server, basically tells this host, run the command that I've specified. In this case, it's the HP proset CL command, which is the HP NIC team NIC utility. And it's going to say to create these teams. Now, this script here that I'm going to run is intentionally designed to fail on the first 2 attempts, and I'll show you why. So let's run it. And let's step over the first one. Actually, we'll step over the first 2. And the reason, if you look at the job that actually ran, you can see that if you imagine troubleshooting these GCEs can be pretty difficult if you don't actually see the machine that they're running on. Fortunately, we actually captured the output that comes from that command, and we show it to you in the job. So if you see that the job failed, we'll tell you why. In this case, the index of the parameter that we specified was invalid. In this case, here we say adapter 7 doesn't actually exist. So you can see what you did wrong there. So now if we run the other 2 commands, actually I'll just do the next one. The third one is to clean up. Step over that, now go back and look, and this will run, it'll take a few seconds, and this will actually create the team. We can then refresh the host. There it goes, it succeeded with information, tells you what the result was. If you execute 0, I know that's good, so I can be pretty sure the team created. I'm gonna go and refresh this host so we can get the latest hardware information about it. And after a few seconds, it will have the team information. Now we can open up the properties. And if everything went according to plan, you can see these are all marked now as team. And we have a new adapter here. This is now my team's adapter. It's ready for use. Now I can attach it to a virtual switch and have that be reliable. So that just show you how to do teaming out of the box. Generally, you'll want to do this in between after when the host gets deployed and before you create your cluster, because you need to have it consistent by the time you get to the cluster creation. Okay, looks like my cluster creation succeeded. You can see that finished. So I actually now have a cluster, so that's good. My OS deployment is still in progress. Let's talk a little bit more about these GCEs. So that was the post-deployment GCE. For pre-deployment, there's my remote. Oh, before I go to pre-deployment, let me talk more about the actual deployment process. So the deployment process, I mentioned before that we deploy the VHD, but before we do that, we have to boot into the machine somehow and get our agent on that machine. We do that by deploying a WinPE image out to that machine. And this is basically the process that happens to do that. When you first install VMM, one of the prerequisites is that you have to have wake on on the VMM server. We use that for the OS deployment process. I believe we use it for VM deployment. We require components from there, and also for P2V for a number of other capabilities. Once we have wake, then you can add a WDS server. In order to do that, you have to first enable the role on the WDS server. If you already have an existing WDS server in your environment, you can use that one. We will coexist with other applications that require that WDS server. So you can use an existing one. Generally, you can only have one on your network. If you have multiple, it's more for different purposes. You have to have a DHCP server in your environment to do this. That's a prerequisite for WDS because it piggybacks on the DHCP protocol. And basically, when you add the WDS server to VMM through the add resources Pixie server wizard, what we're going to do is we are going to install the VMM server, VMM agent on that server. That VMM agent will give us the ability then to also copy a WDS provider to that WDS server. That WDS provider is what lets our VMM server intercept the boot requests that come in, those Pixie protocol boot requests. When we get one of those requests, we'll check to see if it's one that that originated from VMM. If it is one that originated from VMM, then our provider will handle it. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. If it's not one that originated from VMM, we'll pass it on to the next provider in the list of providers that are in WDS. So in that way, we can coexist with SCCM, for example, that also uses WDS, and any of the third-party applications that also have WDS providers. So as part of also adding this WDS server, we create a DC manager folder on there in the default remote install directory where WDS is configured. And then we copy our WinP image. This WinP image contains the VMM agent. That's very important because, you know, we have to be able to do things from within WinPE. And then it also contains a certificate so that we know that this is not an invalid P image that's being deployed and trying to talk to the VMM server. Now, one thing you'll notice is we don't deploy an OS image here, again, because we're booting from VHD. We only deploy the WinPE that we need essentially to bootstrap the process. Now, the WinPE that we use comes from Wake, from Windows Server 2008 R2, which was great because it contains drivers that were up to date as of 2009. Many of you aren't doing new deployments to servers that were built in 2009. So there comes a time when you actually need to inject drivers into your WinPE image. Now, it's important that you don't modify the WinPE image that's actually out on the WDS server because we publish the agent and the certificate into that WinPE image. We can also manage multiple WDS servers, and we want to make sure we have the same WinPE image on every server that's out there. So the process that we recommend that you go through. Again, here's another script that will let you do that. And basically what we recommend, you can actually use any method you want to do this. This is just the recommended way. And that's to actually put the drivers in the VMM library, the ones that you're going to use for booting WinPE. Generally, you need the NIC drivers and possibly storage drivers to be in the WinPE image, because that's what you're going to need to actually, first of all, talk to that machine, and then second of all, configure the storage. We recommend you put them in the library and you mark them with a driver tag, such as WinPE. Then when you run this script, it'll go through, it'll mount the WinPE image, it'll use DISM to mount it, and then it'll go and get the driver packages from the VMM server, this is step 4, that match that WinPE tag. Once we have the driver packages, we know where they are, we can then copy them into this WinPE image, and then we unmount it, and the final step is to actually publish it to the VMM server. This publish is the important step, because that's what actually copies it out to every WDS server you have out there. And then finally, we clean up at the end of the script. There are a few other parameters to Windows PE. We actually support another path that doesn't require WDS. We support booting from ISO as well. If you specify, there's a dash use ISO, and you can specify the path, or no, it's actually dash ISO path. On that publish SC Windows PE, you can actually output an ISO instead of publishing it to the WDS server. Once you have that ISO, then instead of booting from WDS, the machine, you configure it to boot from the ISO, and then we can boot, you know, into the OS. You still need to have DHCP on your environment, because that's how it gets its IP address, but it does save you from having to have WDS. We generally don't recommend that way because there are manual steps involved. You have to actually attach the ISO and remember to detach it at the right time. So WDS is generally the way we recommend going. All right, so when I mentioned earlier on that it takes 35 minutes to do the bare metal deployment, this is why. These are all the steps that are happening behind the scenes while your job is running. It's a pretty long process. We automate a lot of this, a lot of what's needed. And we do it in a way that sets up the machine in the way that's needed to get it to be a Hyper-V server. First step of the process is we do an out-of-band reboot. That out-of-band reboot basically says boot the machine into WinPE. You, of course, have to have the machine set up to do a Pixie boot. Then if it is set up to boot from Pixie, it'll do the boot from Pixie and actually talk to the WDS server. The WDS server will get that Pixie request, and then it'll send it to the first provider in its list, which should be the VMM provider. That provider's going to go and ask VM server, hey, did this come from you? And if VMM says yes, then we send the customized WinP image down to the bare metal server. This WinP image is pretty small. It takes about, if everything's working correctly, it takes about 45 seconds. In some networks, you'll need to tune your WDS server if it takes longer. There's a TechNet article on how to do that. Once we have our WinP image, then we can actually, the machine will boot into that, and our agent will start running. It'll talk to the VMM server and say, hey, I'm here. VMM server will say, hey, run these GCEs. These are the pre-deployment GCEs that I'm still going to show you in a minute. After the GCEs run, then we know that the machine's at a consistent firmware level. It has the RAID array, the local storage, local RAID configured. Generally, you'll want to mirror your local disks so that if you have a failure of one disk, your OS will continue to run. And then we'll actually, at that point, create the partitions and format them according to the recipe that's in the host profile. So after we have a file system on there, now we can download the VHD to the bare metal server. And then after the VHD, we inject the drivers that match based on, again, how the host profile is configured. Once the drivers are injected, there's actually one more thing we do before we boot for the first time. We will actually enable Hyper-V at this point. We do it before we boot into the VHD for the first time. The reason for that is it actually saves us one reboot in the process, which if you know how long some of these servers take to reboot, it can take like 10 minutes. So that's an extra optimization that we enable. Normally, if we didn't do it there, we'd get enabled automatically as part of installing our agent. So now we'll boot into the OS for the first time. And then when we boot into the OS is set up to do its customization. So it'll do that as part of the customization. It will join the domain that you specified. And then finally, we install our agent after it's joined to the domain. Here it says enable Hyper-V. You can see here that actually happened earlier. And now you have a new Hyper-V server. If you're just doing standalone hosts, this machine's ready to actually receive VMs. You can start creating VMs on it immediately. Generally, like I said, you're going to want to do your post-deployment GCEs next, step 10. And then, if you want to add it to a cluster, you'll do that next as well. So that's the bare metal deployment process, step by step. So these are the pre-deployment GCEs. So generally what you need to do in order to get these to work, you have to download the WinPE tools from the vendor of your hardware. Generally it'll be a RAID configuration tool. It'll be marked as, for WinPE or pre-deployment tools from your vendor. You need to then figure out what commands you need to run to actually do what you want to do. And then you need to add them to the host profile. Now, we don't have this in the UI for the host profile. We only have it through commandlets. So you have to do this through PowerShell as well. The reason for that is because it's generally a script-heavy operation anyway, figuring out what these commands are that you need to run. In fact, you may need to create a script that you actually send out to the machine. But once you've added it, then it gets reused over and over again once you've added it to the host profile. This is a little bit of what the script looks like that you'll use to do that. First thing you need to do is get your host profile in step one. Step two is to define what are the settings that are going to determine whether or not the command, first of all, where to run it, how to run the command, and second of all, how to know if the command completed successfully. So that's what these new SC script command setting is for. Then, once you have your script command setting, you can reuse that, and then you can call, add SC script command to actually add it to the VM host profile. If any of you have deployed services with VMM, this is very similar to what you would do for a service deployment if you need to run GCEs as part of your service deployment. It's the exact same set of commandlets. The only difference is instead of attaching it to host profile, you're adding it to part of your service. But anyway, as part of the SC script command, you need to specify which executable to run. You specify the script command settings, and then the parameters that are needed to create that. So generally, the first thing you're going to do is wipe any existing configuration that's out there. You want to do that especially if you want to be able to reuse this host profile if you ever need to redeploy the OS. As I mentioned early on, often redeploying is faster than troubleshooting. So you want your script to be able to handle that. So first thing you're going to do is wipe any RAID configuration that's already there. Second is to to then actually specify the parameters to actually configure the RAID that you're going to want to use. So this is example here is using the assumes that you've installed the drivers into the WinPE image or these utilities in the WinPE image in advance. We generally don't recommend that, although some of the hardware vendors require that, which is why we're showing it here. If they don't require it, we actually recommend you put them inside what we call a custom resource. So this is basically you put all the files needed into a directory in the VMM library with a .cr extension. And this custom resource then contains all the files that are needed, and that way your WinPE image is not tailored to a specific vendor, So now you can reuse that WinPE image for multiple vendors. And basically it's the same process except, you know, you put the files in the .cr directory, and then when you actually specify the executable, you're not going to specify the full path. We'll run it from the current directory that we copy the files to within the WinPE image. So this is actually the recommended way of doing it if your hardware vendor supports it. Okay, I talked about post-deployment. Primary purpose is for NIC teaming. You can also do some iSCSI configuration, any other remote command. One thing you generally want to do after configuring the NIC team is actually set the IP address. So you can use the netsh command to do that, to set a static IP address for that team. This example shows the script that I basically just ran, I showed you actually run, but also includes then the second command to do that netsh to set the IP address. If you want to get extra credit, you can allocate that address from an IP pool in VMM and then pass it in as a parameter to this this script command. And that's just a recap of what we just saw. Okay, so we've taken our diverse infrastructure, we've created our layer on first layer on top of it. We've created the cluster, we've created the OS, and we've created the cluster. So now the next step is we're going to start moving towards how do we actually use what we've just created. And so to do that, we're going to create a cloud now. So this is now the cloud part of V0 to cloud. After that, we're going to delegate capacity, just to recap, and then deploy an actual service onto that cloud. So let's jump back into the demo environment. And we will create the cloud. So to do the cloud creation, you go into the VMs and services view. You can see we have a number of clouds here already created. I'm going to create a new one right now. I'm going to go to create cloud. I'm going to give it a name. This is for TechEd. I'm going to select which resources I want to apply to this cloud. I'm going to use the Zero to Cloud demo host group, which has the number of CPUs available. You can also use a VMware resource pool. If you want to use the VMware resource allocation that's defined by the resource pool, you can create a cloud from that if you do have VMware in your environment. You can also put the VMware host directly into one of our host groups and create the cloud from that, but then you'll be using the VMM resource allocation methods. So I got my host group selected. Next, I'm going to select the logical network. This is where these are the networks that I want my VMs to actually be able to connect to. The logical network in VMM is essentially, it's another abstraction that abstracts out the networking, the actual subnets and VLANs from what the user is going to connect their VNIC to. Because very rarely does a user say, I want to connect to, the 10.0.0 subnet on VLAN 5. They say, I want to connect to the corpnet, or they want to connect to the backend network. So this lets you abstract that. This layer of abstraction also lets you have different settings depending on which site you're deploying your VM to. So if your building 42 lab has one subnet and your building 44 lab has a different subnet, you can deploy your VM to either one, just reference the one logical network, and VMM will pick up the appropriate network settings depending on where you actually place that VM. So that's the important thing about logical networks. I do have a session later this week that goes into a lot more detail about that. I encourage you to go to. I'll have that at the end. Next part of allocating resources to your cloud is selecting load balancers. So load balancers are needed if you want to use them in a service for basically balancing out if you're doing a scale out of an application in a service and you want to be able to put a load balancer in front of that, you select that here and make it available on the cloud. Here we have an F5 Big IP load balancer that we're going to use. You then select which VIP profiles you want to use for that, make available for that load balancer. Storage classifications, these are the two that you saw earlier. I'm going to use the gold classification because I think this cloud is important. You can then say which library resources you want to make available to the users of this cloud, where you want VMs that are stored from this cloud to go within the library. And then you get to specify the capacity. This is actually the first opportunity you have to define the capacity of the cloud. We default to unlimited. It's actually not a bad thing to do, is to have the cloud default to unlimited, because you can also control the capacity in the user role, which I'm going to show you next. For now, but if you want to do limited, so you can say I only want to use, instead of 406, I only want them to use 405 of my gigabytes. So I'll do that. And then here is where you can select the capability profiles. The capability profiles define essentially what the limit, the range of values you can specify when creating your VM. We have a number of predefined ones that are tailored to the different types of hypervisors we support. You can create new ones, though. So for example, and I'll show you this in a minute, if you want to create a only allow highly available VMs to go into this cluster, you can create a capability profile that says only highly available VMs can go into this cluster. Let me finish the cloud creation. Go ahead and create that. You can see the cloud is created immediately. Before I do that, though, I'm going to create a capability profile for that. And I go into my capability profile. You see the three that are predefined. I'm going to say create capability profile. And this is going to be Hyper-V HA. Now you can see we have the capabilities for the different virtualization platforms we support. Depending on which one you select, we'll tailor the capabilities that we allow on this cloud to that virtualization platform. I'm going to select Hyper-V because I know this cloud only contains Hyper-V hosts. And down here under availability, I'm going to select required for highly available VM mode. What this means is now you'll only be able to deploy highly available VMs to this cloud. You would also use this if, let's say, you have a lower level of service, a bronze level, and you don't want any highly available VMs to go into that cloud. You can say it's not allowed, essentially. So I hit finish. Now I have this Hyper-V HA capability profile. I can now apply this to that cloud, and I'll only be able to create HA VMs. All right, next step. So I've created my cloud. And I am now going to need to give a user the ability to use the cloud. So in order to do that, I'm going to assign it. Now, if this is an existing user role, I can pick it right here. It's not, I'm going to create a new one. I'm going to instead create one just for my TechEd users. And I'm going to create a TechEd user role. So this is my TechEd attendees. This is going to be self-service user role. You have other types of users. Delegated admin is for if you have, different host groups are administered by different people. You can create a delegated admin and then say that, that delegated admin only has the ability to edit a particular host group or a particular network. It's basically a way of scoping your administrator duties as well. But for the cloud user, it's going to be a self-service user. I'm going to add myself to this user role. I'm going to do DC Manager Lab. There I am. I'm going to say which of the actual clouds I want to give myself access to. It's going to be my TechEd cloud. Click next on that. And now here's our second chance to define quotas. Now here we have two different levels of quota you can do. Number one is role level quotas, and number two is member-level quotas. Role-level quotas are for the sum of all the users or all the VMs that are created by this user role. So for example, if you have your finance organization, you want them to be able to create 10 VMs total, you would specify, you'd limit them here to 10 VMs. But now let's say within finance, you don't want any one user to be able to actually use up all 10 of those You don't want one user to be able to use up all 10 VMs that you've allocated to that user role. So you can then further limit this to say, I only want this user role to be able to create one or two whatever number you want to give them. So that way, you're not letting one user use up all of the capacity of the role. I'm going to go ahead and say unlimited for now. I'm going to hit next. Now we're going to say which resources in the library this user has access to. So generally, as the administrator creates templates of different kinds, they need to give the self-service user access to those templates. Depending on what level of action you're going to give them on the next panel, they may or may not have the ability to create their own templates. So if you really have these users limited in what they can do, you need to add them here. So for example, I'm going to add the production SSU template. This is the one that I'm going to be using to deploy next, so I want this user to be able to add it. You can also give the user, if you do give them the ability to create templates, a place to put their templates and their files associated with the templates. And finally, these are the actions. We now have revocable actions you can apply to this user role. So if you want to create a user role that can only deploy but not actually author templates, sometimes you want to split those duties up to author versus deploy, you can do that here, create separate user roles for each of those. I'm going to give myself access to everything. And then run as accounts. As you give templates and you need to let users get access to SQL Server, you can then put those credentials in a run as account, and then you can essentially delegate those credentials without actually giving them the credentials. Next. And then I'm going to finish. Now I've created this user role, and now it has access to the TechEd cloud. Let's actually log in as that user role. I'm going to go to open new connection. One of the new abilities in VMM 2012, well, actually two new abilities in VMM 2012. Number one, you can actually log in as a different user other than your current user. This was a big ask that we heard from our customers. If your VMM server is in a different domain from the one you generally use for Windows, which is commonly the case, you would previously have to, TS into another machine then to actually log into VMM server. Now we let you specify a different set of credentials. The other thing that's new is we actually let you log in as a self-service user. This is mostly needed so that you can actually author service templates using our service template designer. So here I'm going to log in as my TechEd attendee user role that I just created. And it's going to open up a new admin console in front of the old one. And this one's going to be limited to what the self-service user that I've created is able to do. Here it comes. There it is. So now you can see the self-service user, their view of the environment is much different from what the full administrator can see. For starters, you only see clouds, no host groups, no hosts. You don't even have a fabric tab here, or a fabric wonder bar, as we call it. You have no visibility into the fabric whatsoever. All you see are the clouds that you've been given access to, and that's important, that separation. It lets you, not be tied to your fabric. You can see the fabric resources that you've been given access to. Here's the production SSU template that I gave this user access to. And then, of course, you can see your jobs that you've created. Now, these jobs, even the jobs, are filtered to remove any fabric-level information. So if you get a failure of a job, let's say your host, you can deploy to a particular host. That host name for the fabric admin would be in the error. We filter that out and just show the cloud. Now the fabric admin can go in and see that same error and see what host it failed to deploy to, but the self-service user cannot see that. So we really try to keep that separation so that the self-service user doesn't actually see what's behind the cloud. So here's my TechEd cloud. So I'm now going to deploy a service into this cloud. No, I don't have a service created yet. So I'm going to use the service template that I was just given access to, and I'm going to say configure deployment. Now this is a very simple two-tier service. I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it two-tier. That's going to go into my TechEd cloud. And what it's going to do now is it's going to actually run our placement algorithm on this service to figure out where each of the tiers go within the cloud that I have available. You can see it ran. Everything came up successfully. If it didn't, you would see an error here. You see, we don't get to see any sort of star ratings. Anything you would see as a full admin. If you were a full admin, you would see star ratings to know how well it could go onto that cloud. But here you just see, yes, it can go onto the cloud. It also shows which network that we're able to connect to. So I'm going to go ahead and hit deploy service. And we are now deploying into that fresh cluster, that fresh cloud that we just created starting from bare metal. So there we just took the process end to end. We took the process. Here's what we just saw. So there was pretty much everything. I think I covered all that. Oh, before we do related content, though, go back. So we covered end-to-end, starting with bare metal. But there's one thing I don't want to forget about, and that is, got to switch back to my admin, the one host that we kicked off the process with. There it is. And you can see that, we're on the VM view. Everything went according to plan. It's now listed here. It has an OS on it. And it's ready to get out of the cluster as well. So now one of the things we do is not just, we don't just support new cluster creation. We support adding to a cluster as well. So let's say 6 months down the road, you realize, I need more capacity. All your users have been using this cloud like crazy. Your cluster's out of space. Well, for starters, you have the recipe for how you created the cluster to begin with in the host profile. So you can now redeploy or deploy to a new host. In this case, it would be this HV208. And then it's just a matter of dragging it into the cluster, giving it a set of credentials. And as easy as that, this node will become a member of that cluster. You can see, if I go to my jobs view, you can see the add host cluster job is running. This will take a little while to run. But in the end, you're going to have now a full cluster of three nodes starting from bare metal. Just under an hour ago. All right, so I do want to show you one more thing before we go to the related content. So as you know, we just released 2012, and we started having CTPs of 2012 Service Pack 1. So your question may be, what's coming in Service Pack 1 related to OS deployment? Because, we're making a number of changes in Service Pack 1 to VMM. We had a CTP1 that came out, I think it was 3 or 4 months ago now, maybe more than that, time flies. We have a CTP2 that's going to be coming out very soon. And in that CTP2, we are, this doesn't work on that. First of all, supporting OS deployment of Windows Server 2012, so you can actually deploy your new 2012 servers. This will be with the RC, not with RTM yet, obviously. We're supporting a deep discovery process as well. So I'll show you some screenshots in a minute. But deep discovery, if you remember when I did at the very beginning when I did the add resource wizard, I had to type in that MAC address. Now, we heard from customers, they don't like memorizing MAC addresses of their hosts. They don't like copying and pasting either. They want the information to be actually already there. So we're adding a deep discovery process to the deployment. And basically what that means is, as you do the deep discovery, we'll actually boot into WinPE and collect an inventory of what's the hardware on that host. We then take that inventory, bring it back into the add resource wizard so that now you have this full list of what's in the host. We know all of the NICs. We know the storage. And the reason why that's important is because the next thing that we're doing, which will be available later on, is we are letting you fully configure your networking as well of the host. So this is the ability to configure a new concept that we're coming up with called a logical switch. So it lets you basically configure your virtual switch instances on the host. As you know, in Windows Server 2012, there are a lot of advancements with an extensible virtual switch. So we're letting you configure that with the extensions that are going to be deployed into that switch. In addition, as part of creating that switch, we'll let you set up the teams that go into that switch. And then we'll let you create host virtual network adapters on that switch. Part of the trend that we're seeing, the direction that we're seeing going with server hardware, is we're seeing hardware that contains a relatively small number of 10 gig NICs. Let's say you have 4 10 gig NICs in your new server. You don't want to deploy. You don't want to devote a full 10 gigs to management or a full 10 gigs to, just your cluster heartbeat. You want a smaller amount of your total network bandwidth, but you still need the same quality. You still need a specific quality of service. And that's what these host virtual network adapters let you do. We'll let you, if you have four 10 gig NICs in your server, we'll let you take two of those, give them to storage. You can take the other two. You can team them as they go into the switch. And then you have a full 20 gigs going to the switch, which you can then divvy up into. You can allocate a chunk of that to VMs. You can allocate a chunk of that to your cluster heartbeat, a chunk of that to management. You can even allocate a chunk of that to iSCSI if you want to do that through the switch as well. So we really let you use the virtual switch in a much, much wider capacity. Just a few screenshots of what the deep discovery process looks like. So here you see the same add resource wizard. But if you look carefully, you see a checkbox right under the IP address that says skip deep discovery. Now, we support the same process that we do today where, if you know exactly what's in the machine and you do like to copy and paste, or you do have a photographic memory and know what your MAC address is, we'll still let you type that in and save the approximately 10 minutes that it takes to boot into the machine to collect that hardware inventory. Apparently, they like that next door. So we'll let you skip that process. If you don't skip it, we'll go to the next page. We'll still discover the machines through IPMI because we still have to know that that machine's out there. So we haven't done it yet. We'll still give you one more chance to skip the deep discovery process. We still have to discover it through IPMI, know it's there. We still have to pixie boot into it the same way as before. But now when we pixie boot, we'll collect a lot more information. And then we'll present it here. So for example, we'll collect the MAC address. I didn't actually do the boot, when I generated the screenshot, I didn't actually do the deep discovery, but you can see that if we did, this was just the normal discovery because I used the same machines that I just did. We would show the MAC address. We would show the CDN. This is now also something new in Windows Server 2012. Newer hardware with newer BIOS supports what's called consistent device name. This basically makes it so that you'll know that whatever network adapter is in slot one in your hardware is always going to have a consistent name. If you know how Windows Server 2008 R2 does it today, the network adapters are basically named in roughly the order that they get enumerated by the OS, which can vary. It's not consistent. CDN, if you have the newer machines that support it, will let you know exactly which network adapter you're deploying to. So in that case, you don't even need to know what the MAC address is, even though we'll show it here. You just need to know the CDN name. And generally, the vendors, we expect the vendors will be either putting a sticker on the back of the machine to say, this NIC has CDN1, whatever they end up using for their naming convention. We'll let you choose your IP address configuration and some management. And then we bring this up as well. So if you did do deep discovery, this MAC address field will be pre-filled. We show you the CDN. We show you some more information about this network adapter as well that we learned about it, so you know that you're connecting to the right, you're configuring the right adapter. And then the other thing we'll do, which we do today, is we let you specify the IP address. These screenshots do not yet show the work that we're doing for the logical switch, so those you'll see at some point in the future. All right, so related content. So this was provided to me by our marketing group. Apparently, the person that made this didn't actually want you to go to the other sessions because they're so small. So I'd encourage you to come up afterward and look at them, and if you can't read them from where you are. There's actually some good hands-on labs that are listed there that I recommend you go to. But if you do want to get deeper information about what you saw here today, you want to learn more about networking, storage, and services, MGT 315 through 317, I would consider that the trifecta of VMM sessions at this year's Tech Ed. Learn about networking, I'll be doing that one. Storage management will be done by another PM, Hector Linares, if any of you know him. And then VMM services, I believe, will be done by Stephen Varon, who's in the audience now watching carefully. So I encourage you to either go to these sessions or watch them online after the fact. And that is it. So we have about 10 minutes left. If anybody has questions, feel free to ask away. Thanks. If you want to ask so that everybody else can hear, if there are questions you think the general audience will hear, you can ask them at the microphone. If there are one-on-one questions, you can come up now. But yeah, go ahead if you're at the microphone, or if anybody wants to ask the microphone.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I have a question. Looking at the presentation here, it looks like this one was directed towards bare metal and physical hardware. I'm assuming you can do the same things with virtual machines. And if that assumption is correct, what level of support does VMM have for differencing disks?
So what do you mean by virtual machines? Are you talking about so?
Well, if I wanted to build a private cloud using VM virtual machines as deployed by a virtual machine manager.
So for us, a private cloud needs to be able to host virtual machines. That's essentially how we define the private cloud, is a
okay.
set of hosts that can host virtual machines. Now, within that private cloud, though, you may create guest clusters. You may create different VMs that are able to do whatever it is that you want to do that you would consider a private cloud, because everybody has a slightly different definition. So you may have a private cloud that basically hosts specific applications, for example, that you want to
okay.
create out of a guest cluster or out of some guest.
Okay. Well,
So one way of doing that is you could either deploy those individually as standalone VMs and then build them, hook them up together, or you can put them into a service. You can create a service that contains either multiple tiers, and then within those multiple tiers, you can scale out the individual tiers so that you can essentially have an elastic set of VMs that can grow and shrink.
Okay, well, that's part of the question.
I think that's closer to what you're asking about.
Well, that's part one. Part two is given that model with Hyper-V, I could deploy differencing disks and deploy a lot of VMs, mm-hmm. Using essentially a core template VM,
yep.
and just build on that to save space and aggravation and so forth. And it, from what I can see so far, it doesn't look like that same level of capability exists, at least on the surface, with Virtual Machine Manager. And I was wondering if it does, and if so, where would I look?
Yeah, so for differencing disks, so one of the things that we allow when we do VM deployment, on the very last, one of the very last panels is the specialization panel. Mm-hmm. And on that specialization panel, you can actually tell it to use a VHD that's already on the host. So if you want to do a rapid deployment, you can basically say, use this VHD. And that VHD can be created as a differencing disk so that you can then basically use a golden image that's already out there and just keep reusing that golden image over and over again.
Okay.
I don't believe we'll automatically create the differencing disk. I know that we will do rapid cloning using the SAN capability. So if you have a LUN mm-hmm. On your storage array that can be SAN cloned, we'll let you use the SAN to do that,
okay.
basically do these differencing disks. But we won't do it automatically at the VHD level.
Okay.
But
okay.
you can do it. It's just
yeah,
not
I,
part
I,
of our
I did
UI.
Find one PowerShell script on
yeah,
the web.
Yeah, you generally need to do a PowerShell script.
That,
fully
that did it,
that.
But I just wasn't sure if it was something that you could do at a, from the GUI on VMM.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Any other? Go ahead.
Is the content from the session going to be available on the
MyTechEd?
Yeah,
I'm going to put it on today. I'll put it on the related content within MyTechEd so that you can. I'll put the scripts up. What else did I show that you might want to see? The scripts. That's basically it, right? The scripts that I showed.
Whatever you want.
Yeah, one other thing I have that I'll also put out there is everything you saw in this demo I actually have as one entire PowerShell script. So you can actually run this end-to-end as a PowerShell script. So I'll put that out there, too, as well. It's actually what I use to test the demo in advance to make sure that everything works. So I'll put that out there as well. The slides should be available anyways, I believe, however they make them available. Oh, they might not. Okay, I'll put the slides out, yeah. I'll definitely put them out. Yeah. They record the session. That'll be available at some point, but not the slides. Yeah. Are the slides available?
Yeah, one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought they did make them available. The only thing that's not in the slides that are out there are the What's Next in Service Pack 1, just because I put that together in the 15 minutes before the session.
After you create a new cloud, how are you able to assign an existing VM to that cloud?
Yes. The VM has a property. Let me switch back over to my demo environment. If you actually look at a VM that we have here, let's find one. Where am I? In the services. Hopefully I have a VM that's out there that's not in a cloud already. Apparently I don't. Are all these hosts empty? Oh, I'm on services view. Okay. I get tricked by that sometimes. Ah, here we go. So let's say here's a VM. Let's look at this test VM. If I go to the properties, there's a new VM property called cloud. And if it's not associated with cloud, you can now pick one.
Is that in there right now, or is that SP1?
No, this is in 2012. It's available now.
Okay.
Of course, the cloud is scoped to what's available in the host group that the VM is currently in, so that's why you didn't see the My Teched. You didn't see the Teched cloud I just created, because I scoped that to the one host group. Any other questions? Can you go up to the mic, unless it's you want to ask it offline? Okay. Any other questions that you want to ask the mic? We've got 3 minutes. Otherwise, come on up and take your turn. All right. Thank you.